Welcome to the monthly meeting of the Humanist Union of Madison. Our speaker today is Susan Hagstrom. Susan?
Well, I'll be dealing with the book The Good News Club by Catherine Stewart. It's a fascinating book. I found it very informative and a tad bit horrifying as well. The book starts out with an example of the effects of a Good News Club in one neighborhood in Seattle. To gain a picture of the neighborhood, a Google search on the author's part shows 41 churches. Friendly neighborhood, different religions, people generally getting along. And then the Good News Club came to the school as an after-school program. At first viewed with mild interest, they set up and started operating. To obey the letter of the law, they operated only after school, and yet managed to make a serious split in the school and the community. The Good News Club is not just Bible study. It is a carefully coordinated, well-planned organization designed to turn young school-aged children into evangelical proselytizers. Candies and treats are at all meetings. Kids have a point system for proselytizing and rewards, treats for success. In this Seattle neighborhood, the author starts out with, this led to parents of differing religions having to deal with children being bullied. Quote, Jesus is the best, Jesus is great, don't you want to be with Jesus, unquote. Quote, you're a bad person if you don't believe in Jesus, unquote. Quote, mommy, are we bad people because we don't believe in Jesus? When parents went to the pastor of the church sponsoring the Good News Club, he treated them kindly to their faces, then went online describing the visit not of parents concerned about bullying from the religious standpoint, but of Jesus' work and unbelievers, i.e. the parents. Flyers found in the kids' mailboxes at school, ostensibly advertising the club, but also denigrating other religions, races, etc. I like to pick on Asian Americans for some reason, because of the Buddhism. When the concerned parents tried to monitor the club, they were essentially kicked out of the club. When they held a meeting with the leader of the club, she brought her lawyer. Those in the neighborhood who talked with the author in the aftermath show a good deal of frustration. The general feeling is that they were in a neighborhood that worked together, and now there is a neighborhood that has split apart. And the exhaustion of trying to stop the divisive elements was showing. Ironically, as the author shows in a later chapter, the concerted effort of the Good News Club and their parent organization, the Child Evangelical Fellowship, shortcut CEF, in converting school-aged children is just the sort of action that historically set about taking religion out of the public schools altogether. In her history chapter, the author first describes the synopsis of the new religious right history via what she calls a quote pseudo-historian unquote David Barton. The line given is that religion was a harmonious aspect to all public schools until the 1960s, when prayer was eliminated due to the Supreme Court ruling, then education supposedly failed dramatically due to quote moral relativism unquote. And, of course, this then leads to all manner of evils. Problem is, it's not accurate. At the beginning of America, there wasn't really anything described as public education. Given the numbers, most schools were private and or religious run. It was only around the beginning of the 19th century that funds for public schools began to surface. And to sound similar to present-day shenanigans, religion started going after that funding. In Massachusetts, it was the dominant Congregationalist faith starting the grab, with Unitarians and Episcopalians crying foul. So, in 1827, Massachusetts laws said that we were not to buy textbooks which were calculated to favor any particular religion, sect, or tenet. And in 1937, religious teaching was restricted to quote, commonly shared Protestant values, unquote. Which kind of worked until the Catholics started immigrating. The Catholics then got started to get upset with descriptions in these textbooks of the Pope and clergy as, and I love this quote, libertine, debauched, corrupt, wicked, immoral, profligate, indolent, slothful, bigoted, parasitical, greedy, illiterate, hypocritical, and pagan.
Wow.
Unquote. This is from the book School to Order, A Social History of Public Schooling in America by former professor David Nassau. The big argument then came Catholic versus Protestant versions of the Bible, which to use in the school. Naturally, the Catholics wanted their version, the Protestants wanted their version. Protestants King James, Catholics Douay Theme translations at the time. So in Philadelphia, then 1844, there were two separate weeks of rioting over the issue. In Boston, in the 1850s, and I've never heard of this before this book, the Elliott School Rebellion occurred because there was a mass exodus of Catholics because one Catholic student was beaten for 30 minutes for refusing to read the Protestant version of the Ten Commandments.
By the teachers?
Yep.
Wow.
Incidentally, the way the author talks, this may have been the beginning of the development of private Catholic schooling in America. I.e., you're not getting it from the public school, make your own schools. In Cincinnati, there was the 1869 Bible War. This particular bit of rioting occurred after the school board banned the reading of the Bible, ostensibly to accommodate the Catholics. And it went all the way up to the state Supreme Court, which ruled in agreement of the decision to ban the book. So 1876 speech by President Ulysses S. Grant sums it up, and I'll read his quote from that. He says, quote, leave the matter of religion to the family altar, the church, and the private school, supported entirely by private contributions, he said. Keep the church and state forever separate. With these safeguards, I believe the battles which created the Army of Tennessee will not have been fought in vain. Interesting quote. Pretty much from that period, there were, until the no prayers ruling in the school in the 1960s, religion was generally restricted to the prayers in the public schools. And it was set up that way, as the author points out succinctly, to accommodate the different religions. It wasn't because of any desire to be secular. It's just to accommodate the religions. So much for their historical evangelical argument. A good portion of the book also deals with the organizations behind the Good News Clubs. Very impressive in one way and scary as hell in another. First, there are the legal aspects. After all, the Good News Clubs would not be able to operate the way they do without the legal aspects. Due to the 2001 ruling, Good News Club went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Good News Club pretty much won this ruling, which basically said they could operate after school as long as they weren't within the school. The two major groups mentioned in her book, the American Center for Law and Justice, which the author crips as an anti-ACLU, and the Alliance Defense Fund are the heavy hitters. Her research indicates, though, that these and other legal organizations often have shared boards, shared funding, shared cases, and definitely a common strategy of attack to break down the separation of church and state and pretty much get rid of public schools. And the author compares the budgets. In 2009, ADF, Alliance Defense Fund, had a budget of $30 million. In 2010, ACLJ had a budget of $32 million. In comparison, ACLU has a budget of $110 million to cover all the issues, not just religious ones. And as she points out, they also will do religious freedom as well as separation of church and state. American United has a budget of $6 million. 32 versus 6, bit of a difference. And the Secular Coalition, which is also trying to work on these issues, has a budget of $1 million. The author then pinpoints historically the cracks that have been breaking down the church-state separation. The Supreme Court in 1981 case started the ball. The defining the prevention of groups meeting on campus as free speech discrimination. And the Christian right has been working on that method ever since. Can't paraphrase her readings on this page anymore. So this is her words. Throughout history, to stick with this somewhat slippery distinction, people have tended to view religion as a content. That is, something in the same category as, but different from, art, science, and politics. Most people, for example, are fairly certain that they can identify a practice as religious worship without necessarily knowing anything about the viewpoints involved in that worship. But the court now appears to be advocating a novel theory according to which religion is, in essence, a viewpoint, something that flows free of any particular content, but rather expresses an attitude or judgment about any and all contents. And a viewpoint, of course, is precisely the kind of speech that is protected by the free speech clause of the First Amendment. And the two judges who are most advocating that right now, as you can probably guess, Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas. Second of all, there is the organization aspect. The author for this book attended a national CEF conference in Alabama, a multinational conference called Missions Fest in Seattle, and the CEF teacher training session in Lexington, Massachusetts. The CEF conference was the author's first conference. The emphasis to the author was on getting in the doors of the public school at any price. As described in the book, the talk by the star of the Liberty Council, Matthew Staver, lawyer, was a Q&A session on the lines of what to do if you run into problems. There is also the marketing aspect. The author describes one presentation as, quote, "The conversion of school children is a matter to be managed on an industrial scale." Charming idea. Listening to talks, the author, quote, "can't help feeling that I'm at a conference for a multinational corporation determined to use every managerial tool to expand," unquote. In 2009, she attended the Missions Fest, which has been held annually since 2005, where the featured mission was the Child Evangelical CEF. And walking in and around and describing the surroundings, it seems to match and surpass any marketing conference that she's attended. The author attended a training session while at the fest, as well as an example of a club meeting. The training session, as described, spends more time on getting the children to evangelize than considering issues. The last emphasis on the rules is to spread the word. The children are to be given cards, gifts of Bible type, the wordless book, a book with pages that are gold, black, red, white, and green, pages to symbolize various aspects of Jesus' redemption. This is a method they discovered. If you know about your history of the public schools, the Gideons have been trying to give Bibles to school children for decades. This is a new method they developed. There are no words in this book, but you can get the school children to say, well, this color represents this issue, this color represents this issue. So this is a way they've been getting around not being able to hand out Gideon Bibles. In other words, this group is all into loopholes. Okay, and materials, and the children are supposed to give them to their friends to, you know, help evangelize. One attendee reported proudly to her author of being in trouble in every way possible. Another was attending because her daughter was attending a liberal church where her grandkids were being told that there was no hell. And to top it off, when the author asked the teacher about community relations on the way out, their response was, quote, "The Bible tells us we don't have to worry about anything," unquote. The actual training course in Lexington started with the application. Included within is a statement of faith. I will read to me the worst example the author gave, because you can't miss this one on this one. quote, "There is no degree of a reformation, however great, no attainment in morality, however high, no culture, however attractive, no humanitarian and philanthropic schemes and societies, however useful, no baptism or other ordinance, however administered, that can help the sinner to take even one step toward heaven. In other words, unquote, in other words, loving your neighbor or being a kind, ethical human doesn't matter at all. And throughout the training session, the familiar themes resound. This is the only way to get into heaven. The pleasure in creating divisiveness in the communities in support of their goals. Throughout the book, anybody she talks to is truly proud if they can upset the apple cart and get in. As selling the package through treats, music, glory, and just a touch of the fear of the going to hell routine. She covers an awful lot of other aspects too in this book. The use of schools in the New York are virtually for free as is a result of the development of the Good News Club ruling. So she has a whole chapter where pretty much all schools have to take these people, and they can spend, they don't have to spend anything in New York housing, which as you may or may not know is pretty expensive. The development of the evangelization of children dating back to 1955, with the development of think tanks to promote the Christian agenda. Heritage Foundation may sound not like a Christian agenda right now, but Heritage Foundation did start off with an awful lot of the sort of Christian nationalists working at it. The new 414 philosophy, i.e. if you get kids, then you get them for life. The far-right religious and judicial philosophies of Scalia and Thomas. As an aside, even when authors do their best to portray these characters in a fair light, they don't really succeed in my book. The Texas textbook wars, where the school board was trying to push that Thomas Aquinas should be added and Thomas Jefferson dropped from the history school books. And that Phyllis Schlafly should be added, but obviously no liberal counterpoint. The author ends the book with an admonition that it is not really enough to just pop your ears up at election time. The way of these massive organizations, and they are massive, with a lot of funding, are doing their best to walk into the local school every day. For example, the local CEF is at 201 South Stoughton Road. You've seen the examples of the flyers. The local website lists clubs in Glendale, Baraboo, Madison, and Sun Prairie. So they're starting here too. What, questions?
Susan, when you met Catherine Stewart when she was here for the Free Thought Festival, did you get any impression from talking to her about how dedicated she is to this, spreading the word on this? And you also heard her talk.
I didn't actually get any impression from her that she's far more dedicated in sort of trying to work on the so almost bullying aspect of these religious groups. And they do come and pretty much act like bullies. So she's probably far more interested in that than actually working with the groups. But you could tell from the tenor of the book that by the time she finished researching things, these groups scared her. And she isn't, you know, a fervent atheist or agnostic or anything like that.
I know she has appeared on a number of radio talk shows that I've run across, and I provided links to some of her other talks. And she spoke at the Freedom from Religion annual convention last year.
Mm-hmm.
Could I have the book for a minute?
Oh, okay.
I think there was a...
I have a concern. Is there an effort to incorporate the mainstream churches in fighting this child evangelism? Yeah. Because I don't think the Presbyterians and Methodists and Baptists want this. They want separation of church and state. And so are they, it's too bad if you end up using language that antagonizes mainstream churches because they might have the ammunition to fight back.
Yeah, but one of the aspects you have to always consider is the lawyer aspect. And they have been working on the lawyer aspect for decades. So,
what do you mean by lawyer? I don't quite.
The legal aspect.
Legal aspect.
Yeah.
So they have been working on issues, and ever since that lawsuit where the Supreme Court basically allowed the ability to switch it from "you're preventing me from having free speech" to separation of church and state. They've been having continued success. I mean, it's piecemeal by piecemeal, but they have been having continued success of getting anywhere and anywhere. So the chapter where she covers her first meeting at the actual CEF convention, which is, I think it's held triannually, and they get plenty of people going to it. That Matthew Stavert, I mean, he seems cold. He's just, you know, they say, "You can't get in here." They say they have enough room. And, you know, she's pretty much handing out the phone number of the Liberty Council and saying, "You got any problems, call me up. I'll stick a lawyer on them." So, these guys are being ruthless.
There must be elements in the law profession that are appalled by this.
Well, you got to remember they have the Liberty.
Is there an awareness among them?
I'm not sure.
The general law profession.
I'm not sure. I think you can draw a parallel here in focusing on Wisconsin. I, for one, was not aware of how far right in the realm of politics the local or the state Republican Party is until after Walker started to do his stuff. I was aware that, religious groups are allowed to meet in school buildings, but after school hours. But I, looking at the pamphlets and a quick side note is one of them uses the word disciple as a verb. They want to disciple these children. Yeah. Interesting. But another thing that I learned recently is you remember the old John Birch Society? Mm-hmm. Well, it's still with us. And it's no longer headquartered in Belmont, Massachusetts. It's headquartered in Wisconsin now.
Where?
I don't remember the name of the town. Was it a major city?
Manitowoc.
There you go.
Manitowoc.
That's because I graduated high school in Manitowoc.
There's your answer there?
I know it's real strong during my high school days.
Well, where is it really? Where is it?
Yeah, I ran across this looking for something else, on Wikipedia recently. But there's an affirmative effort, and people who know me have heard me say this multiple times, by a certain group of people in America to rewrite our history, rewrite our religious history, rewrite our economic history, rewrite our political history, and on and on and on.
This goes on in every country. That's, you know, revisionism has been around forever.
Well, true, but it's been a concerted effort that's been damn successful over the last 30 years. And what we're seeing now is some of the fruits of the trees that were planted 30 years ago and nurtured very carefully over time. So I am appalled by what they're attempting to do, but I can't say that I'm surprised by it. As far as I am aware, there is no, other than, you know, the American Civil Liberties Union, when cases are brought to it, I'm not aware that there is any infrastructure within the legal community that specifically addresses this sort of thing. The human cry gets on this sort of thing gets raised by the Freedom from Religion Foundation, which can be pretty aggressive in its choice of terminology and assertions about religion in general.
That was what was bothering me, that here are the potential allies to fight this kind of brainwashing of little children would be in the mainline churches. So it's too bad to be attacking them.
Yeah, no, I agree. I was raised as a Unitarian, became an Episcopalian, and I know that mainstream Episcopalians would be appalled by this sort of thing.
Well, I got a comment to make there. You know, a lot of these mainstream churches are en masse becoming not mainstream and not, I mean, we lived in Kansas City most of our life before we retired up in Wisconsin. And we were brought up, we joined the Episcopal Church. We watched that church completely change. I mean, there's churches there that got up and left, had to buy because the Catholic Church and the Episcopal Church are similar. The diocese owns the churches and such.
The land, the church.
They had to buy the church out from under the Episcopal organization and then take that church and put it under a bishop in Uganda so that they could teach homophobic hate in Kansas City in their church. I mean, this is happening in all the churches, not just mainstream isn't mainstream.
But in the specific case of the Anglican Communion internationally and the Episcopal Church here, that's a minority phenomenon. Yes, there are definite, you can find on the internet lists of churches who have gone exactly that route. And in communities down south, you'll find that where there used to be three Episcopal Church USA churches, one of them has gone off the deep end, and it was started over having women priests. That's where it bifurcated.
And a presiding bishop that was a woman. Oh, that was big schism.
But by and large, the Episcopal Church has been on the forefront of the current wave that is now coming into shore on defending gay and lesbian rights and equality and that sort of thing.
One of the points that Catherine Stewart makes is that elementary age children can't really distinguish between what is a school program and what is an outside program. And I like to read a quote that illustrates this. There is plenty of anecdotal evidence to suggest that young children do in fact form a strong impression that the Good News Club is just another school program. In Will County, Illinois, a Unitarian couple tells of an interesting story about what happened when an 8-year-old Good News Club attendee told their second grader daughter that being Christian was the only way to get to heaven. When their daughter voiced her disagreement, the other girl replied, "It's true. I learned it in school, and I don't teach things in school that are not true."
Right on the internet.
Do the schools have to have these? Do they have to open up to organizations? I mean, the school have to work school to organizations.
That's my understanding of what it is. The fallout from the
all or nothing.
Fallout from the Supreme Court makes it very hard. I mean, we've had this problem even at the UW.
I'm talking about if they said, we're not going to have any organization.
Yeah, they can do it.
Right, it's an all or nothing sort of thing.
So what are we losing if we do that?
Well, there are sports activities and things like that.
That's connected to school.
But it's, they have an after school.
It's after hours. That's not during school hours. It's sponsored separately.
That's a school sports?
Some of them, a club sports.
An example would be the university but the university has courses that are taught.
Extension
classes at the public in the schools.
Are they paying for the space as opposed to?
I don't know whether the extension division pays them, but I
would think. It would be a source of revenue for the school system.
Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. I mean, the description of the places in New York, these churches get the place virtually for free.
I think they pretty much
have to pay the
additional costs. The school incurs such as custodial help.
Mm-hmm.
Right. No rent, just.
Mm-hmm. But you see, that's not a church religion question there, unless it's a religious organization.
Why?
Then I think the idea that they would have to pay rent, I don't think.
It upsets me in a county.
2001.
And that there's a church in one of our middle schools that meets.
On Sunday.
They pay rent for sure.
Yeah, and I get all these mailings from them all the time. And it kind of irritates me that I have to pay to fund that school for a church.
They don't.
It all goes back to the 2001 Supreme Court decision, which they refer to as a God-given loophole. And there's a church she talks about in New York where they actually meet in the public school.
Well, I know.
And they don't pay rent, they just pay prevent the school from having to pay extra to have them there, like janitor, that sort of thing, but not rent.
Do they advertise that as meeting in the school?
Yeah, it's covering the cost.
They put a thing right out on front on Sunday. This is our church.
The actual structural building.
And she, the author went to one of these services.
We have a lot of things. Boy Scouts meet in schools and they're pretty homophobic and.
They certainly are in Kansas. Unitarians pull their kids out. Jewish families and Unitarian families, because they always pray to Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior. And so the second grade boys that weren't.
Maybe I'll take a look at the whole thing in life, you know, too.
Well, I believe that at the time, the controversy with Ann Gaylord's organization came up, and this must be 20 years ago. I think they were performing baptisms in the swimming pool at this high school.
All right.
Well, here are the statistics.
I think.
The first public school, New York City public school, started in 2002 as a result of this ruling. By 2004, there were 20 such school-based churches. In 2006, the number had climbed to 60. But by 2011, the city stopped keeping track. But an informal survey found churches in about 1 in 5 public schools in New York City, putting the likely number north of 200. In the tonier areas of Manhattan, where real estate is the most precious and expensive, a majority of public schools turned into churches on Sundays. In all but one or two cases, the religious groups in question were evangelical Christian, and in a large proportion of these, the churches were the work of, quote, church planting organizations, where they could come from wherever and just have the church there because there's hardly any expenses.
Imagine the uproar if you put an atheist organization in the school.
I was thinking the same thing. When Huey Long was governor down in Louisiana, the story goes, some members of the black community came to him and said, you know, the local hospitals aren't accepting blacks, as patients. And he thought about it, and what Huey did is he started campaigning. You don't want blacks in the same hospital with our wives and children. And he got funding for segregated hospitals, which was, in its day, a step forward. And a similar mechanism might be useful here to have atheist clubs and Satanist clubs, so these people suddenly realize that they're going to be there unless the rules change, and they could easily decide to change the rules on that basis.
Mm-hmm. That's how it worked before. I mean, the Catholics versus the Protestants, and then they had no Bibles in the school.
Yeah. Except atheists aren't organized.
They're trying.
You see, it's the fastest growing religion in the United States.
Fastest growing religious category.
It's not.
I think it was worthwhile looking at this flyer that was passed around the CEF, because when you actually read this flyer, it's worded in such a way that the average parent, especially a low-income parent, would look at this and think, oh, what a great opportunity. Here's an organization that's doing all these things, and it doesn't cost anything, and it's after school, so my kid
you don't have to pay a babysitter.
And all the moral values, and if you happen to be Christian, the biblical stories and studying that this all sounds great. But on the back, it gives a list of 15 items of a statement of faith. And the first 7 of those, especially if you don't read it, or the first 7, sound really great for a Christian family, that they're studying the Bible, the Trinity, the deity, the fall of man, the resurrection. This is everything that you're taught in Sunday school. But then you go a little further, and you read something like, salvation is received by faith alone, which is what you were saying earlier. And the eternal punishment for the unsaved and the reality of Satan. But a lot of people will read that first seven lines and not read
it. They don't read to the end of the page.
This is a very scary thing.
There's also a certain amount of protective coloration in society. It's not like we went from absolute secularism to these guys showing up. When I was in grade school in New York City, I recall that we recited the 23rd Psalm on a regular basis. When I was an officer in officer candidate school in the Navy, we were required one Sunday to all go to a religious service. The rationale was, well, if you're an officer, you need to know everything about what the Navy does. The Navy does offer this to, so you have to go at least the one time. And it was, the sort of civic Episcopalianism that kind of crept into, FDR's speeches and this sort of thing. It was within certain bounds. These guys want to move the fence. And there's some things that maybe the people here would disapprove of, but we wouldn't get all that excited about. This is a lot different. This is an eye-opener. I definitely learned something today.
Yeah, I do too. It's children, you know?
Oh yeah, and some of these principles aren't.
I mean, they're defenseless against us.
Yeah, some of these principles aren't unique to evangelical Christians. The Catholic Church, for years, said, "Give me the child at age seven, and I will return you, the faithful son or daughter of the Church." The specific business about works are not, are useless for salvation. That's core Protestantism. I've heard very literate, highly educated Episcopal priests, talk about that. Martin Luther wanted to get rid of the Book of James, with the quote, "Show me your faith without works, and I'll show you my faith through my works." I kind of like James better than Martin Luther on that score.
I did attend a lecture at the conference they had on freedom of religion last month at the Lowell Hall, and one of the speakers did speak specifically on this subject.
Well, Catherine Seward was one of the speakers.
Yeah, and I heard her speaking. It was quite shocking what she said, how this group is so prevalent throughout the country, and how many students and children actually do attend these activities because of the pressure being put on these children to go. And it's gotten to the point where I don't know if we're even able to stop it anymore. It's so big and so grand.
And for me, at least, it's more shocking. If somebody showed me a pamphlet in the bottom and said, Tuscaloosa or something like that, I figured we'd be okay. Stoughton Road?
Yeah.
Madison?
Road.
Yeah.
And they also use the child enticements that Susan mentioned, the candy and other goodies, balloons, games for kids to come over and play, and
condoms.
There's a statement here about...
I don't think so.
At the end of statement of faith, it says, details concerning the statement of faith and doctrinal protection policy are available upon request. Did you get a doctrinal protection policy in
there? Well, that's what she was sort of describing when she talks about filling out the application. She's got about... five pages just dealing with the application for the training session.
Well, I wondered if it was the lawyers. The protection involves the lawyers. They'll help you with if you have parents coming in. It's that kind of protection.
Well, in the application for the training session, it's far more than making sure they don't get anybody who's, I'm not.
Where are these lawyers coming from anyway? They're all from Liberty University.
Several of them. I mean, Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell both have that in university, and they've been checking out lawyers for the last 20 years. And
Oral
a lot
Roberts
of them deal with this issue.
Oral Roberts has a really
Liberty Council, one of the groups.
That explains a lot.
This has been a good while ago that I was down at the Capitol
for a protest, and it had to do with abortion and the right to life. And the lobby at the Capitol had a huge number of young children who were down there with signs who were anti-abortion. And when I saw that, my response, mental response was they were being brought by their parents and indoctrinated by their parents. They had no idea what the heck they were talking about. Or, but I'm wondering whether a group like this, whether, I don't know how long this group has been around, but—
Here, 3 years.
Just 3 years?
Well, that's the website.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but the group itself has been around for 50 years.
Yeah,
okay. 6 years, but I wonder now when I'm hearing this, whether these kids may have been in a group like this, or whether the kids who are in a group like this now are going down to protest marches.
It's safe that the kids didn't drive their own cars down. and it's also safe to assume a parallel between the parents here and the folks who were bussed in at the time of the demonstrations, political demonstrations over the last couple of years. I saw people getting off the bus, and I now believe that the counter protesters, which the largest number of which at any point was maybe 2,000, if you want to be generous, these people busted. These were folks that from some organization that the Koch brothers had their fingers in, and you have to remember that the Koch brothers are sons of a founder of the John Birch Society. And they've got unlimited resources, and they want to own everything.
Who's funding these organizations, these religions? You got any idea?
They're just protecting it.
The Child Evangelization, Evangelism Fellowship has been around for quite a few years, so they are the ones that fund the Good News Clubs.
Mm-hmm.
They look for churches, fundamentalist churches.
In one of these brochures, it talked about the people that they train are involved in getting funding. So each individual group, I guess, has its own bake sales and phone calls.
That's for the things that aren't done in schools.
Hmm?
That's for the program that isn't in schools. The summer program.
Here's that.
The school program. The school program apparently.
Contributors.
Existence.
Yeah, that's how you can put your CEF in your.
To more than 8 million children each year. That's pretty.
That's a lot of people.
Children.
They have 20,000 employees worldwide.
They have here a reference to setting up a revocable trust. These gifts can be returned to you within 90 days of receiving written notice. So if you got 50 grand, which is what they're talking about here, you give it to them, they invest it, they keep the interest, and when you want your money back, you get it back, is what I infer from this little paragraph.
Yeah.
I was wondering, Ken, if you might want to comment as a lawyer on the fact that this group cannot itself go into a school during school hours and proselytize, but if the kids do it for them, then it's not a violation of law.
This isn't my area of special expertise, but I think that's exactly right.
Well, even if they couldn't, who's going to prosecute the kids?
We had religious discussions in the lunchroom, across the lunchroom tables in high school. And there's nothing that prevents the kids from trying to bring it up and turn the conversation to that sort of thing, and strikes me that that's what they're encouraged to do.
Right, and I think this group deliberately tries to create child disciples to do just that.
Yeah.
What do you think can be done about this phenomenon?
Well, shedding light of day on it is probably the first step.
Right.
Each worker who leads a Good News Club is required to, quote, raise support, unquote, or give a financial donation of approximately $20,000 a year.
What?
Yeah, that's what you found out.
You're buying a lot of candy for the
workers. Typically raise the money from their church or from a coalition of several churches.
So you go sort of like getting a sponsor for a race. You go to the church.
$20,000.
Will you sponsor me to do this?
But $20,000 is nothing for one of these mega churches.
Oh yeah.
My problem is I don't go to any other churches, so I don't know if these things are already infested in. And these, Episcopal churches,
sure.
and Unitarian, not Unitarian, but congregational churches and stuff. What's the organization that was doing the children at home right now? Families, you know, they're...
homeschooling?
The families that the churches are coming up to try and visit Unitarian churches.
Family Promise.
Family Promise. I don't know if you've heard of that organization.
It's a thing where you need 15 churches, and they each agree it's for homeless families in Lake Country, because of course there aren't any homeless families in Lake Country. Because they aren't sleeping under bridges; they're sleeping in cars, and so it's a good program, I think. Lake Country was the first church to say, we'll take a week. It's a thing where they get places to stay, they move every week. It's four families at a time. It has to be families.
They stay in the churches.
And then, you have a house that is an address for jobs, for school pickup. For doing laundry, et cetera, et cetera. And in the evenings, they come back, and that church for that week feeds them, has activities for the kids. It's not a proselytizing thing. You have a van that helps provide transportation. So there's an initial heavy expense.
My reason for mentioning it is that there's an organization that it's in the churches, and you never heard about it, you know?
Mm-hmm. We have Lydia.
And then people, you know, there are lots of organs in these churches. And these mega churches, we actually call them motherships.
We had a lot in Kansas. It was like, every time I get disappointed in Wisconsin, it's like, but hell, I came from Kansas.
I like the idea of mothership, both directly for the science fiction connections, and also for the feminism, which would probably offend a lot of the people that run the mega churches.
I wonder if the school board would tell us which schools have these good news clubs in the Madison Metropolitan School.
Well, I mean, their website lists the ones I mentioned.
Yes, but those were a year ago. It didn't say anything about this school year.
True.
So I don't know.
A lot of tracking you do out there. Keep track of them.
Do they target low-income neighborhoods?
I think they just basically try to go where they can. The neighborhood in Seattle where they went to was not low-income, so that she starts the book out with. And when she was living both in Boston and New York, the neighborhoods they went for, it's probably more targeting to target various organizations. I mean, one of the reasons they wanted to tackle Boston was because of the Unitarianism there.
Well, there's fundamentalist groups in the United States. I don't know if they're winning or not, but they sure have got a lot of money behind it.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
And very vocal.
Well, what seems to be happening is that the largest category are the people who identify themselves religiously as nuns, and N-O-N-E-S, but that within the organized religious community, the old mainline churches are smaller than they've ever been and shrinking. And anything that is evangelical or charismatic, within this sort of community, there are groups that have disputes with one another. I worked for and had lunch for many years with a fellow who went to one of these Christian colleges where you aren't allowed on the faculty unless you believe the way they do. And he could, he explained to me what's the difference between the thinking of an Oral Roberts and the thinking of Jerry Falwell. Thinking of Pat Robertson pretty much believes that you know, revelation has occurred, and the folks over at Liberty University think that you know, God's talking to them on a daily basis, and so there's their dispute. It's not quite as monolithic as it might otherwise seem. The further away from it, the more they kind of blend together. But those kinds of elements are clearly growing. And I would suspect that you'd see a similarity with the increasing polarization of American politics, where there's a division between rural areas with lower average levels of education and urban areas with higher average levels of education.
Chicken or the egg, though.
I would think that one of the things we might be able to do if we learned of a club in a particular school is see that the school clearly identified it as not a school program, have them put up a sign in front of their table, this is not a school program, and a note to that effect if they send any literature home.
Mm-hmm. But again, I think that encouraging where it's possible for individual schools that there be a humanist or secularist group that offers maybe something slightly healthier than straight candy, but something that would be attractive. Balloons would be okay, I would think.
Maybe a ban on enticements of any sort. It's something they could do across the board. Mm-hmm. Any other questions for Susan?
Yeah, what schools sponsor these programs in Madison, Metropolitan Madison? Do you know exactly specifically?
The schools don't actually sponsor it, they let them in.
Yeah, they let them in.
So that's and.
Are these all grade schools as opposed to high schools as well, or?
Well, remember this group wants to target the 414, so it'll probably be mostly grade or middle schools.
Mm. Right. Yeah, I don't think as you went up there, what uses in college have already gotten onto your beliefs already before you get there?
Well, there are plenty of universities out there that don't take that view, and Liberty and Oral Roberts,
well, yeah,
and
but they're drawing on what.
But they're drawing out of homeschoolers and really fundamental, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think Patrick Henry only takes homeschooled college students.
A lot of the stuff that goes to homeschooling is very religious oriented too. If you look at those organizations, we were visiting our daughter who lived in Idaho for a while, and the interesting thing there is that homeschooling is really big, and one of the reasons it's big, and I didn't know this until I got there, is that if you sign up to homeschool, you get money from the state to fund that. And homeschooling can be $5,000 per child at the high school level and $3,500 for at the lower level. So if you have four kids, you've got an income with no income tax or anything on it.
And it's very economically deprived in northern Idaho.
So everybody with him has four children and one homeschool.
And again,
everybody does have four children.
Ought to be finding out about that. That just sounds like one of his programs.
It's the same thing. And again, I think it has, as well as religious roots, political roots. I don't think that the right wing in America dislikes folks because they make movies or dislikes folks because they represent plaintiffs in courtrooms. They dislike these folks because these groups tend to vote for, campaign for, and contribute lots of money to the Democratic Party. And when you begin to look at it that way, what are the very largest unions to the, in this day and age? Well, they are unions whose members work in government. And among the very largest are the teachers' unions. Why would they demonize teachers? For the same reason they demonize these other groups. They want to defund the Democratic Party. And if they can defund the schools by diverting money that would otherwise go to the public schools and have it going elsewhere, then there will be fewer teachers, and the teachers' unions will have less clout. And you know, I don't think this is paranoia. I think it's part of a very well-observed and documented pattern.
No, I think you're right. I think the Republicans are very, so more well-organized than Democrats. The Democrats don't know what they're doing. The Republicans have really got this thing down pat.
The key ingredient is ideology. And when you don't have an ideology, then you have to think for yourself, you entertain new ideas. Scientific method seems to be a kind of a cool thing where you don't assume the results, you test and so on and so forth. But once you embrace an ideology, any ideology, somebody else is doing all your thinking for you. And one of my theses is that the average American adopts a religious identity and a team to root for and a political affiliation largely out of protective colorations to avoid conflicts with members of the family, the neighbors, and other people in the community. And if you're putting as much thought into selecting a philosophy, a moral philosophy, or a political philosophy as you are into a team to root for, these are the results.
Yeah, that argument would work better if we could get more than 20% of the American population to vote in an election.
And right now, the current version of the Republican Party nationally is trying to get fewer people to vote.
And I translate this, move this over in my thinking occasionally, to the gun thing. You know, the liberals are all about getting rid of handguns and all this sort of stuff. Meanwhile, that other side is just stocking up. And if there's going to be a conflict, they're going to...
I think us liberals are teach it.
Which is a little far
afield. I mean, you could use that with all sorts of arguments. The anti-abortionists are going to have kid after kid after kid, so they're going to populate the world where... The people who are for birth control will have like be responsible and have one or two kids, so it'll be like these 3 million people.
Well, they just assume get rid of contraception.
Yeah, and Bertrand Russell said in the 1950s, he said he thought it was curious. Here's the Catholic Church arguing against birth control, but most of the children who result from the lack of birth control are going to suffer eternal damnation in hell. How do you justify that?
That's
Bertrand Russell, that ain't me. I'm just quoting. In paraphrase.
Do you happen to know by any chance whether the Good News Club, when they advertise or put a sign up in the school or wherever, do they say that they are sponsored by the Child Evangelism Fellowship?
Sure.
And I doubt that they do.
If they do, they probably do it in the typical, I mean, this group is really well marketed, so they probably do it in the typical little small handwriting, little right. This corner there saying CEF or something.
Yeah, if people who might look at this and think this is a good place to send their kids, right. If they saw that it was sponsored by...
This is the kind of thing presumably they hand out, though. Is it?
Yes, but it says CEF, but what I'm saying on the door, when the kids find it,
equally
this is
large
available.
Yeah.
Yes.
But even if it was there, who would notice?
A lot of people.
Yeah, and who knows what it means? We drove by that place.
She's right.
Every time we say, the heck is that?
If somebody said a list of foundations that have been formed with specific social agendas, political agendas that have been in front of you, the names that these things are given are so ambiguous that you need to know. Right.
Child's evangelism is not so ambiguous.
Well, it is. Maybe it means we get children to go out and evangelize.
That's what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Or maybe it means we evangelize children.
But
first,
both.
You do that, and then you do the same thing.
Well, but for a lot of Americans, I think they have really poor vocabularies, and I'm not sure they know what evangelism means. I mean, you have an evangelical Lutheran church here in Wisconsin, and it's like the difference between that and the Missouri Synod.
It's huge.
I know it's huge, but I don't think most. Yeah. I don't think most Lutherans know, much less most.
Especially when you've got Wisconsin Evangelical Senate, which is
even
worse than Missouri Senate.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like, I don't think vocabulary is a high ranking.
Not only vocabulary, it's confusing.
High ranking, but it might help. I could easily see a parent look at this Good News Club and say, that sounds fine.
Oh, yeah.
But if it said sponsored by child evangelist, might think twice.
I just wonder if they're looking for low-income areas or higher income. I can't see their gain as much. They can gain more in the higher-income areas than they can in the low.
Money-wise,
I can see it being very attractive to a low-income person
who
cannot afford after-school care.
You got it.
Yeah. If you consider that technique about the Friday night talk with anybody who wants to lead a church has to cough up $200,000.
I don't think it's about money. I think it's about head count.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, they.
God is
looking
for souls.
I think for the rank and file foot soldier doing this on a volunteer basis, it's about numbers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and about the people behind it, the Don Birch, you go back and back and back. I think it's about something else.
Yeah, they've got the money. Who printed the pamphlets?
Yeah.
You're working with kids. It's not like the Watchdog people that have to come to my house and get abused,
Watchtower.
You're the Watchtower.
It's not Watchtower.
I would be interested in hearing anybody who hears about a particular Good News Club in a Madison school, if they could tell me that something like that's going on, then I can bring that information back to the group.
I wonder what they do if you went in there to try to sit in on their meetings at the school and see what's going on. Would they permit that, or would they call the police or something?
No, they're probably permitted as long as you didn't start expressing it.
A public school is public. They can't have a closed meeting there, I don't think, can they?
Well, they could call the police and then you say you're disrupting things.
Well, and they might threaten you with their lawyers and that sort of thing, but...
It could be that you have to have a child with you to know what they're leading.
That's supposed to be accompanied by children.
No one allowed taller than this line.
I was on the school board in Monroe for 9 years, and this issue did come up in terms that we had to have in our policy manual that no group, there was freedom, no religious group could be excluded or something like that. It's a different version on the freedom, not freedom from religion, but that religious groups could, no religious group could be suppressed.
But again, if a small club is formed in one of these schools, to evangelize children in favor of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. I think it will cause some rethinking.
Well, I was leading up to the fact that I wonder if a group that's working to deal with this would make any headway going to the school board convention, yearly school board convention.
The
school boards are lay people. They're from every walk of life.
Where we came from, Indiana.
There's some school boards that are extremely. Monroe, the school board was pretty good.
Much like Kansas, one of their tactics was run for school board.
Well, yeah, that's why
Kansas had somebody that got on the state where they could teach creationism.
Oh yeah, Texas
biology class. It was like,
well, this went back and forth. They'd have election 1 year and then the right wing would win, then the moderate would win. I'm sitting at a meeting one time where they're speaking, the people speaking. I said, I got an idea. I said, and why don't you just teach two science classes? Why don't you have a creationist class
evolutionary class, and just put on the transcripts. Biology and evolutionary biology.
Yeah,
I'm not telling you.
Oh, the creation people, the human cry that went up was like, of course not. That's it.
They don't want,
it's like,
they
don't know what to
identify.
They
want to push that belief on you.
Yeah.
And they don't want their kids identified with creation belief either. It's the weirdest thing I've ever seen.
I thought it was such a nice compromise.
I liked it.
Yeah.
We can afford two classes. I said it. We can afford two classes.
Yeah.
Well, if you were talk to Eugenie Scotto, who runs the National Science Center for Science Education, a lot of scientists really object to creationism being called a science, but other than
what
that...
What do you think? Actually,
that's why we put it on the transcript.
The Unitarian minister, before he'd been Unitarian at Shawnee Mission on the Kansas side, had been a PhD geology, marine geology kind of thing, and they wanted him to be the person to debate. And he said, I won't debate it. There's no question. Get somebody else to actually stand up there and say that it's a form of science, and I will debate it. I thought it was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much, Susan.
Nice job.
I do recommend the book if anybody wants to read it. It's in the library.